So it's got the two long and the two short for the boys and the girls. And Laurel's got stakes on Monday, too, on the 26th. The heft and the gin talking for two-year-olds and more. Parks has got to be, these are all $100,000 races. So there is some opportunity. Louisiana, those will be Louisiana-bred stallions, though. Not that there can't be, you know, some of the headliners. Bolt Doro, he's got himself, I think, a couple $100,000 lead. So, be interesting. And in Santa Anita, for instance, the Blue Norther and the Eddie Logan on the 27th, on day two of the meet. So, take the break. Eric Hamelbeck first, then Sid. More to come at the races, Sirius XM.
At the races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, LeaderShield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Jones. And a as we always say, since her incredibly, incredibly tragic passing, she was so sick when they recorded that Christmas album. It's unbelievable the strength she had to muster to. It's incredible. In fact, that and the other one, I put two on the list on the Spotify At the Races Christmas music playlist that is I put out last night. So for your Christmas party, basically it's like 2 hours of our Christmas music, and it'll make your Christmas party completely rock. Everybody's going to leave the house, Eric. You're going to play it, and everybody's going to say this was the best Christmas party ever. Eric Habelbeck joining us, and boy, it's a party for Eric every day.
I could sit and listen to Dick Bell and his grievances all day long. I think we need to set him up a podcast because we need to get him to that Hallmark moment to get some holiday cheer, man. Jeez. I love that guy.
He's the greatest. I think we've actually hit on a direction for his title. It has to be director of the airing of grievances.
That's right.
The director of grievance airing. That's what it is. There it is. The director of grievance airing. Dick, congratulations. We have come up with that title. No, he was great. Well, Dick's got, you know, he's got that horizon, you know, historic perspective that, you know, he's been around. And
He knows that Park Avenue Club very well.
There you go. And Dick, and the best part about Dick is, you know, Dick is an unvarnished viewpoint. He doesn't owe a living to anybody in the industry, and yet he's fully invested and a stakeholder in the way that he is, and he just lays it out. So
agreed.
Yeah, we can't, you can't beat that. Well, speaking of laying out things, the conversation that that really started in Arizona, and we sort of knew that there was going to be an attempt to create a legislative fix, at least in the minds of HISA and their legal team, Eric, and sure. Mitch McConnell pitching in, doing what he does, that voodoo so well. The attempt to put this fix into this spending bill, and at the same time, Peter Eckerbert, your general counsel, basically saying, "Do whatever you want. It's not." One line is not going to change the constitutionality aspect. Why do they think that it will?
Well, that's a question that certainly should be pointed at them, because I don't know. I mean, I guess to address first, you know, we do believe that the fix, as we called it, a one sentence fix, because in essence, you know, the other wording was, you know, legalese, but what they wrote in as a fix doesn't address even the entire lawsuit per se, the points on the suit that were filed and subsequently upheld in the Fifth Circuit as being unconstitutional. You know, without going into a lot of details that would be better suited for Peter to explain, we had three main points in our lawsuit, and as we see it, this fix really only addresses one of them. And we now believe that in this fix, they've actually removed a portion of power that the FTC did have. So the bottom line is, as we see it, this fix still leaves the corporation under HISA subordinate to the FTC, period. And so for us, that still remains unconstitutional. The other part of it is, Steve, and I think you've touched on it, and we've touched on it several times, at this point now, there are four cases trying to protect the horsemen. In other words, trying to define the problems that lie within HISA. And even if this fix does, you know, cover one aspect of our lawsuit, there are three other lawsuits that are litigating different aspects of unconstitutionality. And that was the point that Peter was trying to make. And obviously, you know, when we're trying to do a statement quick, you know, you don't get to go into all of the explanations, but I thought he did a great job in just, you know, laying out several of the aspects that are still considered unconstitutional. And that's a problem for horsemen. It's a problem for all of us. You know, again, I'm going to say it like you and I've said it. We all want uniformity, and we're trying to get to that point. But at this point, the unraveling of HISA continues to fall down, and we just want to get something done right. But this fix, A, doesn't really fix all the problems in our lawsuit, and B, certainly doesn't fix any other problems that are currently being litigated.
The counterbalance, talk about the Grassley
sure.
portion of this and what he's basically just trying to extricate that from the bill.
Right. You know, there's some terminology and, you know, syntax that people talk about the amendment that McConnell put in, and it can be seen a couple of ways. You know, it's a part of the bill. Right. I mean, it was amendment in that it doesn't have to do with funding the government. But as written, it's a part of the bill. Again, over 4,000 pages, actually over 4,100 pages of bill text. So we have a tremendous amount of constituency within our affiliates that aren't, you know, based in Kentucky, that have big problems with the way HISA is going to be governed. What I sometimes call the flyover states, but, you know, the real heart of racing. And one of those is the Iowa HBPA. I mean, they have been, you know, adamantly against the way HISA was rolling in, and, you know, is one of the few affiliates that actually held an in-person town hall, much like we did here in Kentucky. And Senator Grassley was present. So he got to hear a very vocal group of horsemen and racing commissioners that did not feel as if HISA was the right thing for the state of Iowa. We also see that in West Virginia with Senator Manchin. So what has transpired is constant messaging has ultimately led Senator Grassley to offer this amendment, now we'll call it a true amendment, that would actually strip the language from the omnibus bill itself. It's now bipartisan in that both Senator Manchin and Senator Grassley have signed on to it. And the language is very simple, just removing that HISA fix from the bill, period. It's gaining quite a bit of momentum, per se. Lots of outreach to senators from constituents within their states. And ultimately, this amendment could come down to a vote. And if it is voted upon, obviously majority wins. If the majority say to take it out, they will take it out. Now, we're not guaranteed that it'll even be voted on, Steve. I mean, the way politics works, it's very fluid. At the end of the day, we know that yesterday or last night, they voted just a motion to proceed, but they haven't gone through cloture yet. So the amendment is in the mix to possibly get a vote, but we're certainly no guarantee that we will. If it comes down to a vote, looking at my flowchart whip board with my team in D.C., there are a lot of senators who don't want this coming to their state, and they feel as if putting it in the omnibus package was completely the wrong thing to do. And that in and of itself created a lot of conversation with Senator McConnell in particular before the bill was dropped to please don't put it in there. Again, without going through any proper process, Senator McConnell put it in there. You know, and I've even seen on Twitter now that things were done properly, and that's just completely incorrect. I mean, I'm sorry, but this was wording that was put together in a room with whomever and put in. No other debate on the fix, or even if the fix was wanted by the industry, it just showed up.
Well, this is, you know, this continues to be the MO, and no amount of you know, PR work and you know, claiming otherwise, you know, kind of changes. It's really kind of amazing. They just keep doing the same.
It is.
They do the same thing over and over again, and then out of the other side of the mouth, we're told, you know, about all the transparency and how eager they are to listen and then here's another foray, you know, down the blind alley that nobody gets to be involved with. It's crazy.
Exactly what I said last week. Redundancy creates chaos, and they just keep churning this non-transparency and trying to, you know, somehow make it as if it is not true. And it's actually coming back to bite them, so to speak. I mean, again, you know, I'm not going to bash anyone on the other side. We all are trying to get to uniformity. But, you know, my charge has been very steadfast from the very beginning, and I've lost a lot of friends over this. But at the end of the day, I just want to make sure things are done right. And people can continue to bash, you know, the national HBPA is corrupt. I'd love to see some fucking proof on that. You know, bring it to me instead of just shooting that crap out on social media. But, you know, we have done nothing but try to protect the interest of horsemen. Either side of HISA that you are on, we just want what's best. And, yes, you know, whether it be a compact or another piece of legislation that is similar to HISA, we do think that we can move forward. We do think people are going to look at things through a different lens. And at the end of the day, I'm ready to lead that charge. But we need to focus on the problems that we have, get them over, get them done with, not keep churning up more stuff and more cloak and dagger hidden pieces of information. Let's try to get to a point where, and you said it, you've been saying it since Arizona, everybody can kind of sit down, look at things together, and see where we go forward. But right now, HISA as a structure as it is, and even with this fix, is not the right move.
And just to, you know, just to touch on, so that group of people that, you know, that are calling HBPA efforts, you know, obstructionist and status quo, et cetera. There's at least four elements to this. And anybody that took the time to read Peter Eckebert's response, mm-hmm. will see them. And first of all, there's the whole funding that, you know, particularly Ed Martin has repeatedly waved the flag and said, you know, if Mitch McConnell is going to, you know, gerrymander this whole project, then why not help us by, you know, by funding half of the budget? That would go a long way toward helping everybody take the next steps. But from the constitutional aspect, Eckebert pointed out there's three defects that will still exist. Number one, a non-federal private entity, which is HISA, granted the power to levy taxes. That's unconstitutional. I mean, it's not even debatable whether it's constitutional. Tenth Amendment violations for anti-commandeering. Maybe I could bring in Dennis Drazen, who explained it for a decade before sports betting was allowed.
Exactly.
Dennis made that case evident. And then Fourth and Seventh Amendment violations for lack of due process. And violations of the Administrative Procedures Act, and it's very funny that there's this group of people that seemingly don't have there's one group that doesn't have any stakeholder status that are just that just want to throw brickbats, but then there's some that may have some stakeholder status. They're going to feel very differently when they're caught up in, in potential flagging, with the changes, of how we're going to test, for instance, and that whole shift, and Mary Scolay's admonishment that, well, this is how it's going to be, and there's not going to be any lead up time, and there's not going to be any, we're not going to give anybody any leeway. So we'll see how some of those supporters feel, some of those owners, and even some of the horsemen feel when they go to respond to a violation and they recognize that they have no due process. We'll see how they feel about this whole concept then.
Well, in bringing up Dr. Scalay, I believe it was a TDN piece where she was interviewed and, again, talked about the new Bible, which is offensive on a lot of levels. But at the end of the day, some of the new information that's been coming out from, I believe, Mr. Sheeler's piece and Ms. Lazarus's piece, that they're all of a sudden not going to test in picograms. I don't know where that came from, because when you really look at the technical document of substances and the lack of what we would call, we would call now thresholds, they're going to detection times. I don't think that even some of their talking points at this time actually match up with what people are reading in the rules. So, again, there are things that are being said that I think are just ultimately confusing folks even more. And that's what we need to kind of get right, get the ship right, because right now we're getting information, people coming out and making statements such as Mr. Sheeler for what I would consider almost the first time since the corporation was created. Why has he not been out talking to this point now on the defense? I find a bit disturbing. So I'll get off that soapbox.
Well,
I don't want to go down another rabbit hole as Dick drives.
Well, so in terms of a timetable for everybody to watch as they finalize their Christmas shopping, and I dropped a couple dozen Christmas cards in the mail yesterday. Tina worked on Sunday night and Monday. As you do all that, you'll be watching watching for the TDN alert on your phone.
That's right. And again, the vote's going to come this week. Again, it's the amendment from Senator Grassley and Senator Manchin. We can't let them know how much our appreciation is for them doing this. But at the end of the day, it may not get a vote. We'll know about the omnibus package, I'm sure, by the end of the week, because the reality is there's a massive storm heading that way. And I know, those folks want to get home for the holidays as well. So we'll just have to see how it plays out. But at least we're trying. But I do want to make sure everyone knows that this quote-unquote fix doesn't fix HISA.
Eric, if we don't talk between now and Friday, and there is every chance we might.
But if not,
best to you and Deb and the kids, and
thank you,
everybody. Thank you. The rank and file as well, of course.
Absolutely. You and Tina enjoy the grandchildren, and have a have a great time, and hopefully we can talk a little bit more. But I get to go to Miami for Christmas, as long as we can get out of here from the weather. I've got my nephew that works for the Dolphins, and we're going to go to the Green Bay-Miami game on Christmas Day. So I'm really pumped about that.
Well, I didn't know you had you had a Dolphin a relative on the Dolphin staff.
Yeah. He's well, he works for the Dolphins. I don't want to better make that clear. He doesn't play for the Dolphins.
No. Actually, it's on the staff, but he works for the team.
Yeah, great kid. Loves his job, and it's going to be a lot of fun with Deborah and her brother Bob and his wife Sarah. It's their son Tyler that works for the Dolphins. So we're going to have a great time. Can't wait to get down there and enjoy a little bit of warmer weather. It's supposed to be cool for South Florida, though.
It's been cool everywhere. Wow. Have a tremendous time. That's very, Eric, I appreciate this. Thanks for the update.
Thank you, Steve. All right. Yes, sir. Thanks for having us. Talk to you soon, brother.
You got it. Eric Hamelbeck, and there's your update. And, you know, the mention of football, I know we'll do this obviously with Hammer again. You know, he was with us yesterday. But the news this morning that Franco Harris had died overnight. I haven't seen any update, but I mean, I just saw the headline and the immediate piece of news. And it comes what? He was about to be, today's Wednesday, so Saturday or Sunday, it was going into the Steeler Hall of Fame or the Circle of Honor, whatever they have, retiring his number. It's the 50th anniversary of the Immaculate Reception. Just awful. And, the other one, and actually, you know, Sid's going to join us, and because it's a baseball topic, this is the second, the second passing that it feels really, you know, shocking and surprising based on the age of the athlete. The other night, and I'm going to forget who alerted me, that Tom Browning had died from the Reds at 62. Unbelievable. And so, and then here's Franco Harris. I mean, he was in his early 70s, but just really sad. And Sid joins us, and Sid, I'll tell you my Tom Browning story after years and years of wanting to see a no-hitter. I had seen a lot of cool things in baseball games. I had never seen a no-hitter and had come very close several times, including at Shea Stadium in maybe 81 or 82, 82 probably, because I was living in the city already, or living on the island. At Shea Stadium, Phil Niekro carried a no-hitter into the ninth and gave up a hit with none out in the ninth. And then when I moved to Cincinnati in 84, if I've got this, I think 84, Mario Soto pitched one of the most famous near no-hitters ever. He retired 26 straight before George Hendrick hit a monstrous home run, just monstrous, to dead center. And not only did it break up the no-hitter and the shutout, but it tied the game. And so Soto stood, I think he had struck out 16 or 17. He was just, they didn't come close to touching him that night, except for the Hendrick home run. And then Brad, what was the catcher? Brad Goulden, I think, drove in a run so that the Reds won 2-1. But then finally, in 1988, I had gotten tickets. I was back visiting Cincinnati, staying with my friend Doug and Patty, Doug of the Warsaw Falcons, the drummer. And I got tickets for a Friday night game, and Browning was scheduled to pitch. And it poured down rain, and I mean poured. So it looked like the game was either going to get postponed or delayed to start. So as it happens, Doug's wife Patty was divorced. She had to drive to Lexington to pick up her daughter her husband Hills, and for the weekend. So there's no game to go to, Sid. So they Doug and Patty get in the car with me, and I drove them down to Lexington. And every so often, I would go check WLW to see what the status of the game was. Sure enough, because back in those days with the artificial turf and that riverfront, the Ohio River could overflow, and they would have played a they would play a game anyway, as long as the water receded. So we're about 15 minutes into Cincinnati, you know, away from Cincinnati, coming back up on 71 or 75, and here's Marty Brenneman. Well, they're taking the tarp off the field, and we're about 20 minutes from the start, and it's like 10 o'clock at night. It's like it's 2.5 hours delayed. And so Doug and I dropped Patty and the daughter, and I'm going to, I want to forget her name. She lives in LA now. She's in entertainment. And I said to Doug, I said, let's go, right? He said, yeah, yeah. So we dropped the girls off, and we come back down to Riverfront, and there's next to nobody there. It's like 10:15 at night. And we missed the first inning. We got there for the top of the second. So we missed the first three batters that Browning retired. But we did see the next 24 that he retired. And,
wow.
Yeah, so I count that as having seen a perfect game, even though I missed the first three outs. I saw Browning's perfect game, and it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable.
That's a fantastic recounting. To me, the sickest perfect game with an asterisk is, you'll remember this one. It's got to be like 94 or 95. It was the young Pedro Martinez with the Expos.
You bet.
And 9 innings. I think it was the Padres, right? Yeah. 9 innings. Perfect game, but the Expos couldn't get him any runs.
Nope.
And so he had to go into the 10th inning. They finally got a run in. So it's 1-0. And then Pedro comes out for the 10th and gives up like a hit. And so it doesn't get counted, you know?
Yep.
And for 9 innings, it was a perfect game. And I think he was only like 22 or 23.
I was living in Montreal at the time, and had season tickets, the half package. My buddy Dave Kaufman and I would go very regularly, and we did not go. It was the summer of 95, and
that's right. Yeah, 95. Now I remember.
And
that's when like Pedro would have been like 22 or 23, but he was, the most significant thing about Pedro back then was he was like 5'9 and 135 pounds. You know, I mean, he was skinny, and nobody thought he would last, you know, and it was just, it was one of the most incredible performances I've seen on TV. And that's when Pedro became like, it didn't matter what team he played on. I could never root for my team, the Yankees, whenever Pedro played against them, because to me, it was, you know, one of my favorites.
That 95 season, of course, is a tragedy of just insane proportion, because the Expos, they never would have left Montreal had that season been completed. They would have gone to the World Series. They were, if I'm not mistaken, they were 74 and 30 when the strike came. And
what a tragedy.
Beyond belief. There was a new stadium ready to be built, and anyway, I mean, as it happens, when it comes to Martinez, I've got here in the somewhere in my collection of autographs and cards, There was a Guess jeans clothing shop on St. Catherine in Montreal. They were very active sponsors, in fact, I think, of the Expos. And they were going to have a card signing, a meet the players thing.
Right.
And they printed up these cards. They were nice size too. They were like maybe Remember those oversized football cards when we were kids?
Oh, yeah.
It was like they were even wider than that. They were perfect for autographs. So one of the reasons I wanted to go is my favorite expo was going to be there, Rondell White. Mm-hmm. And in addition to Rondell White, there was F.P. Santangelo, the little pesky kind of fourth outfielder. And he could play anywhere. There was the rather tragic Ugueth Urbina, the late inning specialist who ran into terrible problems back in the DR or wherever he went back to. But then there was also there was those three: Rondell White, Santangelo, Urbina, and Vladimir Guerrero and Pedro Martinez.
Yep.
And the funniest part about Pedro was the way they had them sitting. He was fifth in at this table, and so by the time you worked your way down the table, some of them were signing as you went by, but he had obviously signed like a pile. So he was at the end of the table, and by the time you got to him, he'd be like, I remember him sort of holding up the card with two hands, like saying, would you like mine? And it was it was so funny.
Wait, was this after that game?
Oh, yeah. This would have been, this had to be because Guerrero, because Vlad turned up, I think, maybe 2 years later, maybe 97? Mm-hmm. Give or take, 90, right in that, he showed up. Should look that up. I mean, but Guerrero, and I don't know if they're worth anything. Maybe I don't know. But
so you got Pedro.
I got Pedro. I got Vlad. Rondell. I loved Rondell White. He was my kind of player. Eric Davis and Cal Daniels from the Reds when I lived in Cincy. As we affectionately call them, the Vern Rapp years.
Yeah.
The best part of living in Cincinnati on the baseball side, living in Cincinnati is a lot what I imagine it was like for people that lived around Ebbets Field and Brooklyn in the 50s, where like the players were part of the community and this is true of the Eagles too. But in Cincinnati, first of all, There was one point at one of the teams when I was living there, Sid, something like 7 or 8 players on the Reds had grown up in Cincinnati, which was a huge hotbed of baseball. Dave Parker. Dave Parker.
Local boys.
Yeah.
The local boys, yeah.
Dave Parker and who else did I, at the top of my head, Pete Rose, but just being around. But there were, I think Cal Daniels was from Cincy. And, so they had all gone to local high school. And so you'd go to the nightclubs, and they were all hanging out. I mean, with like friends that they grew up with.
Yeah.
You go to January's, used to hang at January's. I got to know Joe Price. it's funny. Or the precinct, you go up to the precinct, which I think Johnny Bench had partly owned, and they'd be there. I mean, you'd be bellied up to the bar with guys on the Reds. It's just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And then of course, teams would come into town, and they'd hang out. So, and occasionally you might, if you were, depending on the party favors you had on hand, you might find yourself up in a hotel suite later with an after party.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Well, we had our share of fun, Sid.
That's a great story.
Too funny. Yeah. Well, Sid, thanks for joining us. No, I'm.
Oh, man.
I'm in a great mood. What's the before we talk season ending? What's the Christmas agenda?
Well, the Christmas. We were just in New York for the last 5 days. I just got back yesterday. And we're just going to be, you know, somebody asked me what we're doing for Christmas, and I said we're going to a Chinese restaurant.
Here you go.
Yeah, just the two of us.
They're just and along with lots of Jews. That's a Jewish tradition.
Of course.
It's nice you saw the grandchild, and
yeah, it was great.
Good.
Everything was
good.
Yeah,
good. Good.
Geez, a lot of fun.
Nice. We got the same.
Except it was cold as heck, man.
Yeah. You can't. Yeah, there's no avoiding that right now.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we just got back and doing my column this week a few days later because of my delay. It's going to come out in the Friday paper, but it's going to be on Practical Joke, who, of course, is the sire of Practical Move along the La Salle Fraternity.
And listen, Practical Joke, and really, you know, we talked as we were tracking the first crops sires with Bolt Doro, of course, leading the pack right now toward the, you know, with 10 days left. It feels like there were even more successes than normal. It feels like right?
There were.
There was
horses are peppered all over the leading sire of 2-year-old list, which is really amazing. You know, usually you get, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3, but the trend has been accelerating, and there are a lot more. 3 you just mentioned in the fight for the championship, plus you got, you know, Gervin. You've got several others in there in the top 10. So Sharp Azteca, Army Mule. Yeah, that's 6 right there in the top 10, you know. And, of course, Practical Joke is in with his second crop this year, and he's done extremely well. So that's basically the focus of my column is what great value he is for $25,000, because when you look at some of these other stallions that are on this 2-year-old list, you know, Into Mischief, of course, is leading. He stands for 250. And even these freshmen, for example, Justify, his stud fee had been advertised at 100, but it's at 150,000 now. Steve, and Bolt Doro was advertised at 35. You can't get to him. He's book full, and the only seasons on the market are trading at the equivalent of 55,000 live foal. It's basically 42,000, no guarantee. And if you switch that to a live foal with insurance, it'll cost you 55,000. Good Magic is at 50,000, selling fast. So, you know, when you look at the leading sire, a list of 2-year-old sires, which includes all sires, Violence is there. He's 50,000. Both Violence and Good Magic are at Hillendale. So, you know, you take a look at Practical Joke, and I just called up Coolmore yesterday to double check. He's still 25 and is available at 25, and that's a hell of a bargain.
Now, and you know, it is on that topic, actually, you're looking at bargains, and we should mention. And maybe we'll pick it up, Sid, after the first of the year. But Chris McGrath's always entertaining value sire sequence has started. He's got the first two, right? Parts 1 and 2 have come out. Always good reading. We'll put the plug in for Hillendale. For Hillendale to land 2 first crop stallions in the top 4, Good Magic and Army Mule is really notable. And, you know, good magic. There was a certain expectation being a Curlin son, but Army Mule as a complete bargain and a son of Frisian Fire is a smashing success.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. And good magic. I mean, he's got, you know, three colts on the Triple Crown trail and only one of two freshman sires, along with Gerben, to have a grade one winner in his first crop so far.
Yeah, just looking at that, actually. And, yeah, Gerben, and one thing about Good Magic, he's got four graded stake winners overall, and only Justify can boast that. You know what's amazing about Justify's success? He's got six black type winners tied with Good Magic overall. But here's what's notable: Justify's third in overall earnings, $2,299,000. But his top earner has only made $197,000. That's verifying. Everybody else among the top, their top earners all have made $300,000, $400,000, $400,000. So he's built that $3 million in earnings, you know, without the figure about 10% below, you know, in terms of he needed
that's a really good point.
One or two less earners to. He's got more horses, it seems, earning. He's got 10 black type winners. Bolt Doro has 14.
Black type horses.
Yeah.
Not ringers.
Black type of any kind.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you know, you always like to point out percentages and what those standard levels are. Percent of runners, you know, versus foals. Percent of winners versus runners. Percent of stake horses, you know, to the total.
Yeah, and Justify's done really well. Even when you consider the fact that he never raced at two, and you know he's known as a triple crown winner distance. But what's interesting about him is that the horse you mentioned, Verifying, isn't even one of his black type winners. You know,
yep.
And the thing with this loss of futurity, it was a. You know, he had the overwhelming favorite in Arabian Lion. Had Arabian Lion won that race, it would have given him seven black type winners and five graded winners. It would have also closed that gap with Bolt Doro significantly. And so that really was a major lost opportunity for justifying the loss of futurity. Ironically, Coolmore America's other horse, Practical Joke, ends up winning it. There's all sorts of ironies in that race. But another irony in that race, of course, is that Practical Move, who won it, was bred by Chad Brown and Soft Human.
Yeah.
And the horse they beat was a horse that's raced in Soft Human's colors because it's that big Avengers partnership.
Yeah. Well, and that, well, that Act Naughty, right? That was one of theirs, the Chad trained.
Yeah, for the head of planes partnership of Sock Human. And so that mating was obviously a full share with Chad's share in his breeding right in Practical Joke with that mare. They bred it, and then, you know, they sold it for something like $235 or something. So it's, you know, it's an irony that Sock Human's stallion colt buying group ends up getting beaten by a horse that he co-bred and sold.
A couple of other notable and maybe just interesting sidebars that I got to mention. How about said down going down to number 12 on the freshman sire list? Awesome Slew, the son of Awesome Again, Mrs. Weber bred, stands at Ocala Stud for a listed fee of $4,000. He had, yeah, listen to this, he had 36, a total of 36 foals. 21 of them have made the races, which is a gaudy number. I mean, two-thirds of the foals to even get to the races is a 50% is a solid threshold. So this is 66%, and 12 winners. So one-third of the ones that have made it to the track have won, which is which is a very nice number, 33%. Most normally you'll see, you know, 20, 25% is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a, you know, also we have to pay a tribute here to Ocala Stud, because Ocala Stud also had Gervin.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from that group, you've got Gervin and Awesome Slew. Awesome Slew's by Awesome Again. And, you know, it's a hell of a performance from two freshman stallions from that farm outside of Kentucky.
There's a lot of interesting things to glean in here. I mean, we should probably mention the Oscar performance, and I think what would be considered a very successful first crop, right?
Absolutely.
For Mill Ridge.
He's number eight.
Yeah.
He's number eight. He's got two black type winners. And, you know, for a horse, you know, that was a turf horse, those types are usually up against it. And he's done extremely well, and he's gotten dirt winners. He's got $1.5 million in progeny earnings, too.
Right ahead of him on the list, Motown, who we've talked about a lot. We've got the Motown baby ourselves, and that's under tack and training at Country Life. Another turf horse, actually, that's getting that's had decent, more than decent, Good Samaritan for Windstar, $7,500. Has got 51 runners and 14 winners. There's a lot to be gleaned here. Sharp Azteca was has got the most winners total, 31.
Got 32 now.
32, okay. Add another one. Actually, Mendelson had the most runners get to the races, 86 out of the 153 registered foals.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good.
And he's got, what has he got? He's got
all
one
of these horses have, you know, really a good chance to continue with their success, which is really a stellar group of freshman stallions, no question about it.
Sid, let me ask you a different topic, and obviously we'll recap all this after the first of the year once the numbers lock in. Yesterday, in the conversations, most notably with Hammer, back from the American Graded State Committee meeting, and then Andy had some interesting, you know, reaction, and you know, as somebody that is distinctly involved, I mean, as you know, working for the New York Racing Association, what is your insight and you know, general overview over the years of how the Graded State Committee is handling the horse population and the decisions of, you know, raising and lowering gradings, and, you know, managing essentially the, you know, the infrastructure of graded stakes and listed and black type in this country, and you know, how much influence do you believe the breeding community has over the way this is done, and you know, your overall reaction to what we heard on Friday in terms of the ups and downs?
Well, I think it's you know, it's basically run by the breeding industry, because it's under the umbrella of TOBA, Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. So, you know, the graded stakes, it should be run by the breeders too, because essentially what this is it's, if you just break it down to, let's just talk about it, black type. Well, black type means, it literally means the black type on a catalog page.
Right.
You know, if people aren't familiar with that, if you open up any catalog page and you look at hit number 22 or whatever in so-and-so sale, every sale, you'll notice that the type is in black bold type for stakes winners. And so essentially what black type is it's a gauge to help breeders and buyers of bloodstock look at a page and see the notable runners on it stand right out. You know, if nothing was highlighted, you'd have to actually read line by line to see what they won and so forth. So that's basically what that's for. It was meant to be an aid to the breeding community, and that's what it is. But of course, it's taken on a life of its own because they assign grades to races at various racetracks, and those races, of course, become marquee events for those racetracks, and each racetrack cherishes its graded races, right? So whenever there's changes, there's a outrage from some, and you know others are flattered that grades went up. As an overall process, I think there's been one big flaw in this thing, Steve, and that is this: the horse population. Say from the 80s or wherever, when it was in the 50,000 range, there were essentially the same number of graded races and black type races as there are now when the horse population is at 20,000. So what that could mean is, if you just follow logic, it could mean that it's easier to get black type right now versus, 20, 30 years ago. More horses back then. Now, of course, another argument is that there's always a certain number of horses that are only good enough to run in these races. But having said that, the sheer math of it points to it being easier to get black type. And so if these are supposed to be some of the best races and therefore the best bloodstock that has this black type next to its name, it should be, one way of looking at it is it should be much more difficult to get that black type. So I think that's one of the arguments that's always taken place, Steve, when you try to analyze, the worth of graded black type on a catalog page, which is separate from, from fans. Everybody now, they're familiar with graded races and tracks want grade one races and so forth. So, there's always, Andy was talking about, a couple of races that got downgraded that he was upset about vis-a-vis some other races that are grade one races that,
right. That could seem to perpetuate themselves as grade ones without, seemingly without the enough of the substance that is being applied to the ones that are being downgraded.
Yeah. Now, apparently they have a system. They get quality ratings apparently of all the horses that run in each of these graded races and make decisions that way, but it's still, you know, it's still controversial.
The graded portion of this is, it's obviously more important for the mares, for the brood mares than it is for, I mean, there's the handful of stallions that are going to, you know, of the males that are going to make it, you know, into the breeding arena.
Grade one races are important for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. For that elite group.
Yeah. You know, and there's also talk now that, you know, the way the game has gone, everybody talks about all these races as now preps for the Derby and the Preakness. And, you know, there's talk about, you know, taking some of these preps and lowering their grades. You know, people are talking about, no, just because the concept is there now that people view these races as preps, and the Derby has done its job to make it that way by giving points in these races, as if, you know, the Derby is the ultimate race, which it is, you know, for what people want to win. However, you know, there are certain races, like the Florida Derby, for example, that end up producing more, you know, stallions, quality horses, than some of these other races. And and you get very high level 3-year-olds in those races, and those are quality races. So if you drop the Florida Derby to a grade 2, for example, you know, and that's part of the chorus, I think it diminishes a pretty important race in terms of breeding importance. So, you know, it's, I'm not really that vociferous in how they want to do it one way or another, but, you know, I do know that there's certain races that are more important than others, and people say, well, the Florida Derby is a prep and it's only for 3-year-olds, but, you know, the concept is your 3-year-olds, all your top 3-year-olds running against each other end up being better horses than some of these older horses that are running in grade one races. You know, it's like your top group of ball players are, coming up through the draft, and those guys end up having a bigger impact generally than others, you know. So I think that the understanding among people that, you know, older horses are better, it's not the case. You know, what happens is your 3-year-olds run through the year, a bunch of them get retired to go to stud, and the ones that don't, who don't have the qualifications, races older horses now, and frequently they're not as good as 3-year-olds from the year before because they were never among the best of their crop.
Right.
So why should they then get quote unquote grade one races for them just because they're older horses? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And that's an interesting, I'll tell you what, that's an interesting counterbalance to the call for, you know, taking grade one status away from, at this point, it would be the Florida Derby, the Santa Anita Derby, and the Bluegrass. Bluegrass had dipped down to 2 with the Wood. The Wood is right now a grade 2. Louisiana's a grade 2. Tampa just lost its grade 2, now a grade 3.
Yeah, but that is the counterbalance. So I gave that other side to the argument.
Right.
If you're in the, you know, if you really look at it logically, you know, you know, older horses, you know, if the impetus is to try to breed classic winners, which has always been the case, classics have always held sway as your elite races. Well, to breed classic winners, you want to have good two-year-olds and early season three-year-olds in the pipeline as breeding stock. And so a lot of the best ones compete against each other in these preps. They end up frequently being some of your best horses. In the old days, your best three-year-olds would run at four. And so you did have some of your elite horses running at four and five. You know, your spectacular bids, affirms, you know, they would run at, they were great three-year-olds and they would run at four. So, you know, that concept was a little hidden back then. But now you have your top horses retiring and you have your second and third tier three-year-olds from the prior year running as four-year-olds. And to reward them with grade one races, while ignoring some of the their better contemporaries, is the counterbalance to this argument.
Right. Interesting. All right. I'm going to get, you don't want to do, I'm going to get Chuck in too, because I know Chuck is an advocate of making the preps, that no prep should be a grade one. That was like,
yeah,
that,
Chuck is an advocate of that, and a lot of people are, and I'm not saying one way or another, but I think to really, Chuck is also fully aware, because I've had this conversation with Chuck, that your older horses are, you know, not the best of those crops. If you go by the crop year, you throw a dart at any of the older horses running, they're not the best from that crop. And frequently, you know, they may get defeated by the three-year-olds. You know, usually the old adage was that a good four-year-old will beat a good three-year-old. But, you know, you get a good three-year-old like American Pharoah, and he beats everybody in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
That, you know, that's actually an interesting, let me reach down here. That's an interesting juxtaposition to look at, see how often we've had 3 year olds as horses of the year, and also to look at the 4 year olds that became horses of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it would be interesting to then, you know, to look at horses. I mean, we know why Flightline wasn't able to get to where, you know, to where he got, you know, with an earlier launch point. We know why Arrogate, you know, how the Arrogate, you know, the delays getting him to the races. Who else recently? I guess Accelerate probably, right? I mean, he didn't get good till, did he get, was he four or five that year?
He might have been five.
Nick's Go. Mm-hmm. Nick's Go recently, right? And even a turf horse like a Bricks and Mortar, you throw turf horses into the mix. You know, there's all kinds of reasons. What's your, and there's an interesting question too, Sid, and then we'll pull up, but I don't know if you heard Dick, I thought was very salient on the turf portion and the money that's being devoted to turf. It seems like we sort of forgot maybe why we were doing that, other than, you know, the fact that the turf races are advantageous from a wagering standpoint. They attract full fields and turf horses stay healthy. You know, what our motivation was to throw the kind of money we did at it, in particular with the stakes program, to lure, you know, we made out a big deal of luring international participation, to come take our money. But, what has it gotten us, and is it damaging? Is it damaging? You know, the dirt. You know, the dirt speed route community. I mean, that was a theme that kind of cropped up yesterday with Andy, and then Dick picked up that mantle too.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, from a wagering standpoint, turf races fill more. They get bigger fields and create greater handle. And then, of course, that's one component of it. The other is that there's been a movement that kind of ties in with the jockey clubs, HISA, and internationalization of the game, and what's that word they love to use? International harmonization. And so there's this no basics, run on turf, have international competition, and you know, I'm not against it. I love turf racing myself, but it's you know, it's part of that whole thing that's created this big turf. And I've done articles over the years on it, documenting the tremendous rise in turf racing in this country. In the old days, you went on the turf when your horse couldn't run on dirt.
Right.
You know, John Henry couldn't run on dirt in the beginning. And he gets on turf and, you know, he's a different horse. And so that paradigm has kind of changed now, where horses actually debut on turf.
Yep.
Meant for turf, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, it's created an international marketplace to actually go to Europe and buy. Now it was first made horses coming here from Europe. Now yearlings are being purchased and brought over for these turf races, and they're killing domestic bred horses, obviously.
Yep.
Because turf racing is, you know, the main component of Europe. It has created a kind of interesting paradox that we have, kind of similar to when we were going with a lot of all weather racing too, you know.
That's right.
And yeah, so it's just part of the evolution of the game, and the people in power deciding what to do and where to put the money, and everything is rolling around that. But the dirt racing here is still the bread and butter. That's the one everybody wants to win, the classics, right?
Yep.
So you have that component still, and it's difficult in the turf realm right now for us to be able to breed horses to compete with the horses that can be purchased abroad. And so, yeah. When people say it's giving away money to a lot of Europeans, that's true.
Provocative yeah. Topic. Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Good discussion. Well, Sid, some final thoughts for last appearance of 2022.
it's been a great year. You know, I was just talking to somebody. You know, we started the year when I went to Tampa for the races in January, we were wearing masks, you know.
That's true.
And, we're not for the most part now. Things are changing. During this COVID period was also the period where we had these big indictments and then convictions of a group of people in racing. We've had the HISA passed on an omnibus bill in 2020. Nobody had a real good say in it. And we're now reaching the point on Friday whether the same omnibus bill, the spending bill, will have another HISA kind of amended piece stuck onto it to counteract the Fifth Circuit's ruling of unconstitutionality, right? So things have changed and things are almost back to the same again.
There's a parallel. I suppose I could trot out the Santayana quote, but about condemned to repeat the past, but we'll see.
That's right. Well, I was trying to come to that for you. I was laying that ball on a tee for you. It was constructed that way. End with a ball analogy. As we began with baseball, we end with tee ball.
But I'm pumped. Said, as always, outstanding. It's been a great, great, great season. And a lot of the racing was terrific. And nobody can argue that, which sort of. Yeah, good racing solves all of our problems, frankly.
Cheers to that. And I got to say, you know, we got a chance to see this horse Flight Line, and you know, that was really some spectacular stuff on his part.
Very much, the work that it was really a testament to everybody that was involved.
John Sadler, his crew.
Yeah.
The ownership, a lot of people behind the scenes that aren't as well known, like the Bloodstock agent David Engordo. It was an unbelievably great story, and it made it a year to remember for sure.
Very much. Well, yeah. We'll start it fresh with Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and of course, Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. Write it down, memorize it, put it in your phone. Roger and Sid, the time really is now. I mean, 10 days from now, we're going to start seeing foals reported. We'll be seeing baby pictures and, foal patrol. The people will be tuning in. And then 6 weeks later, essentially, so we've got to call it less than 60 days now before the Stallion Barns open and your mares start getting covered. And the time is now. If you haven't made your decision or if you're waiting to see what your mare drops and how it looks, be in contact with Sid and Roger. Work Thoroughbred Consultants, your broodmare compatibility analysis, 510-490-1111. Sid, thanks for everything.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Have a great holiday.
Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. We're going to take our second break of the morning. We've got about 45 minutes left, and we'll talk to Chuck Simon and to Seth Merrow. Clifton Park and Amsterdam being well represented in the last hour here. Although Chuck's back home, I want Chuck to weigh in on the graded stake because he's of the belief that those preps should be grade twos. That a prep for the biggest grade ones. Remember we had this happen with, the Fountain of Youth, I think, right? The Fountain of Youth became a grade one for like 10 minutes. It was like, well, wait a minute, that's not right. And did the Jim Dandy, Alston, that happened to the Jim Dandy too? For like a season or two, or like two seasons maybe? It was like a weird, where the obvious prep that was always the, you know, I don't want to call it a stepbrother, but a stepping stone. It's a stepping stone brother. Hey now. Back after this, we'll see what Seth is like, for action too today, because, you know, we got the bad weather's coming. Turfway tonight, the big, big, big crazy fields. 12 by 12 by 12 by 12 by 12. Unbelievable. I guess we're taking a break. Back after this.